Thanks, Bill. Almost like feeling that was Be Here Now, right? I couldn't resist. And lovely to follow Barbara. At breakfast today, Barbara and I were discussing how long we know each other. We realized we've known each other for 35 years. So lovely to hear you once more. But whereas that was the feminine, ebullient American version, this is the more sober British male version. So, let's look at a few terms. Consciousness. Let me just define how I'm using the word consciousness. Well, there's two ways of using it. One, the way I'm interested in is the fact that the one undeniable thing in all our lives is that we are conscious. Every moment of our experience, we are conscious. If we weren't conscious, we wouldn't be experiencing. It's the one thing we absolutely know for sure is that we are aware. And we could, I mean, this could be an illusion. We could be dreaming right now. We could be in a dream and suddenly you wake up and realize, oh my God, I was dreaming. I was in Promega, this conference. Or we could be, it could be the Matrix. We could all be sitting in the Matrix. And this all could just be a virtual reality. But still, the one thing we would know is even if it was an illusion, we would be aware of the illusion. And that's what I'm interested in, the fact that there is awareness in the cosmos, that we are aware. And I don't see this as limited to human beings. I think all creatures are aware in this sense. All creatures are conscious. You often hear it said only human beings are conscious. In scientific literature or talking to scientists, they say, oh, human beings are the only conscious creature. My retort to that whenever I hear that is, well, if you took your dog to the vet to have some operation, would you ask the vet to give it an anesthetic or not? And they say, well, of course. Well, I say, if you don't believe your dog is conscious, why would you want to make it unconscious? Clearly, we imagine other creatures feel pain. We imagine a dog sees the world like we do, experiences, not quite like we do, but sees the world, it hears the world. We imagine it's an experiencing being. I think what people mean when they say other animals aren't conscious is they're pointing to the fact that we are conscious of being conscious. We have self-reflective consciousness, which is what I want to talk about a bit today, is the nature of that. So when we talk about the evolution of consciousness, I don't see that consciousness itself has evolved. It is always present. What's evolved are, if you like, the forms that appear in consciousness. I sometimes call it the contents of consciousness as opposed to the capacity for consciousness. The capacity is always there, but the forms, the contents, are what are evolving, continually changing. I mean, they're changing in our own lives from one moment to the next to the next. Our experience is continually changing. And over time, hopefully, evolving in the sense that it's getting deeper values, greater depth of awareness, that's happening. But that evolution has been going on, as Barbara pointed out, throughout the history of the universe. Teilhard's law of complexity consciousness. And as creatures developed senses and began to take in more information from the world, they developed nervous systems and brains able to process that. So the forms that appear in consciousness get richer and richer and more diverse until, you know, with other mammals, we probably have a similar sensory consciousness to ourselves. In fact, you could say dogs are more conscious in some respects. If you take their sense of smell, it's like 100,000 times more sensitive than ours. Or their sense of hearing, they can hear frequencies we can't hear. So in purely sensory terms, you could actually say a dog is more conscious than a human being. I think what's made the difference with human beings, the primary thing, is the fact that we can speak. The fact that we can share our experience with each other. I mean, many animals communicate, but speech allows us to take an idea and generalize it and share it with other people. So what makes human beings different is we can actually share our experiences. I have something I learn, something I discover, I can share it with you. That's what we're doing at this conference. We're just sharing our ideas. And by doing that, we gradually build up a collective body of knowledge. So as other creatures learn from their own experience, we learn partly from our own experience, but as much, probably even more, from the experience of others. And that's what brings us together as a culture. A culture is a set of shared beliefs, shared values, shared experiences. You say the whole of science is really just one great big body of collective knowledge from just shared experience through speech. And education, again, education, which we consider so important, not always, but should be, is that taking the collective learning of humanity and sharing it with the growing people. But then the other thing that language has given us is we use it internally. And this is what we call thinking. We talk to ourselves. If you look at most of your thinking, it is actually conversations you're having. Some of it useful, some of it repeats, totally, or imagining things that never happened, might never happen. But a lot of what we call thinking is a conversation we're having with ourselves. We're talking to ourselves, and this has led to the ability to reflect upon our experience, to consider what is happening, to reason about things, to work things out. It's given us the ability to, in a sense, expand our concept, our awareness of time. I think most creatures live in a very sort of what they call the immediate present. We have evidence that animals will remember what just happened and have some sort of foresight into what might happen. But we can go back over our whole lifetimes. We can go into the future. We have the power of imagination, of it, be able to go into the future to think what might happen, what might not happen, what would be good, how do we do this, how do we change things, which has given us an incredible power of creativity and innovation. And if there's one thing that marks human beings out, I would say it's actually we are the innovative species. We have created so much. I mean, everything in this room, apart from the flowers, is a result of human innovation. We've seen some need, we've had some desire, and we know how to manipulate the world, how to change it, and we've created whatever it is, furnishings, structure, light, projectors, we've created all of this. We are the innovative species. The other thing that thinking has given us, the ability to reflect upon our experience, which is what I want to look at today, is we actually then recognize that we are conscious. We become aware that we are aware. We're not just aware of the world and all that's going on. We can pause, stop, look at ourselves and say, wow, I'm actually a conscious being. What's called self-reflective consciousness. And that's what I think other animals probably don't have. I say other animals, we have to probably leave aside for the moment things like dolphins and whales. We've no idea what happens with them, but they're pretty smart and aware. They are some of the most compassionate beings on the planet. But just with human beings, for the moment, we are self-aware. We are conscious of being conscious. And with that comes the sense of there must be an I, a self, some individual being that is aware. And the sense of self that we have at this stage in our evolution, for most of us, the sense of an individual self, is really, we're only really half awake to who and what we really are. And what I want to talk about today is the process of awakening as really awakening to the full awareness of self? What do we really mean by self? What do we really mean by I? I mean, I once wrote a piece called Does God Speak English? Because the word I is so simple in English. Every other language is complex, but it's like one stroke of the pen. It's also one, the same symbol as one, the symbol I. So simple, and we use it, I don't know how many times I've used it today. We've all used the word I many, many times. What do we actually mean by I? If you ask people that question, who am I? Usually the first thing that comes to people's mind is a name. Who am I? I'm Peter Russell. I'm Peter. Which is probably our first identity we have as a human being. When we're very young, we get to learn, I am Peter, you are Mary, you are Ian, whatever it is. I have a name. That's probably our first identity. And it's actually probably still our strongest identity in some ways. I have a complaint which some of you may have, which is called onomastic aphasia, which is you meet someone out of context on the street who you know well and you just cannot remember their name. You can remember everything else about them, how you met, what they do, conversations you've had, everything, but for the life of you, you cannot remember their name. So embarrassing. Because the name is stored in a different way than experience. And people get very upset about that. It's like, hey, you know, I can remember everything else about you, it's just your name I can't remember. But because that identity with our name is so strong, you can't remember me? You can't, yeah, of course I can, I just can't remember the name. That's such a strong identity. But then we build up other senses, you know, my gender, I'm male, British. We build an identity from the roles we play in life, what we do, our profession, our education, our history, our background, our values, what we believe in, another very strong sense of identity which we often find hard to let go of. We have all these different senses of who I am. And there's lots more, but you know what I mean. What comes up in the answer to that question, who am I? And all of these are in some way or another derived from our experience of the world, our interaction with the world in some way or another. And because of that, they're forever vulnerable. They need maintaining. If somebody threatens my sense of identity in some way, you know, says, look, that piece you wrote the other day wasn't actually very good. It's like, me? I'm a writer. What do you mean? We easily get threatened. A lot of our time is spent bolstering our sense of identity, wanting to be seen, wanting to have attention. And I think so much of what goes wrong in the world, from the personal level to the social to the global level, comes back to us trying to prove who we are in some way or other. What we often call that sort of egocentric activity. The seven deadly sins, if you look at them, all come back in one way or another to this, to the ego, to the wanting to have something for ourselves or protect ourselves in some way. But none of this is I. These are all things I think I am, all things I identify with. The real question is, what is the I that is identifying with these things? What is the I that is experiencing the question, who am I? What is the I that is experiencing the answers that come up? And when we say identify, the Latin for identify is idem facere, which means to make the same as. We make the I the same as this, but it isn't. And this has really been one of the core searches of the spiritual traditions is to discover the true self. What do we really mean by I? was written above the oracle of Delphi in Greece, know thyself, as the supreme commandment, know thyself. And when I first started getting interested in spirituality and came across, you know, these questions, you know, what is the self? I was reading the Upanishads, ancient Indian texts who talk about that, you know, there's this pure self, the true self. I imagined it was some amazing, maybe psychedelic-like experience of discovering something which was going to be wow. And then as time goes on, the wow begins to get less and less and less, and realizing we all know it. We all know that sense of I. It's that I that is experiencing this moment right now. It was experiencing Barbara's lecture, experienced yesterday. The same I that has experienced every moment of your life. We know it so, so well. It's probably the most familiar part of our experience. That I'm aware of this, I'm aware of that. But our attention is always focused, or most of the time focused, on what we are experiencing. We don't actually notice that quality of I that is experiencing. It's really just that quality of being aware. And you could say I, in that pure sense, is just the name we give to that sense of presence, of awareness, that is always there. And it never changes, never changes. It's that same sense of I-ness, for me, it's that same sense that was there when I was a kid, when I was a teenager. Is that thread that runs through our life. We sometimes say, or I hear people say, you know, I'm not the same person I was 20 years ago. When you look at that, there's actually two eyes in there. There's the eye that has changed, the person. You know, I am not the same person. My values have changed. My experience has changed. All these things have changed. Maybe my whole personality has changed. But then there's the I that is aware of that personality. That I is hasn't changed at all. And I would go so far as to suggest, because it has no individual quality, it's just this pure sense of beingness, I-ness, what it feels like for me when I use that word I in that deeper sense is exactly what it feels like for each of you. So in that sense, we know each other on a very deep sense, that I know how it feels to be me. My thoughts and all that may be totally mine and totally different from yours, but I actually know what it's like to be you at that deep level, and you know what it's like to be everybody else at that fundamental level of beingness. And I think that's one way in which we are profoundly connected, something we share, we all share. And that, and not only do we share that beingness, we share the same basic desires of that beingness, which is ultimately to be at peace, to be at ease, to find fulfillment, to find happiness, which you might think is a very egocentric thing, to be looking for one's own happiness. And certainly the individual mind, what I was talking about earlier, that sense of self that's based on the body, is continually looking for how to find happiness in the world. But I think that the basic root search for a sense of inner well-being, inner peace, is universal and totally natural. The Dalai Lama once said, in the final analysis, the hope of every person is simply peace of mind. And I like to very loosely, this is a very simplistic model, to divide our experience, our sort of states of consciousness, into two different states of consciousness. There's what I call natural mind, when there's no problems, everything's okay. You probably know it when you're sitting out in nature looking at a sunset, or quietly at home listening to some music. You're not really thinking. You're just there, you're just being, enjoying the experience. And in that state, there's not a strong sense of individual I-ness. You're just there in the present, enjoying the experience. And it's a state of peace, contentment. And then something happens. Maybe you start feeling cold or hungry, or it starts raining if you're outside. Something changes, and you move from contentment into discontent. There's something that needs changing, we're not happy. And that again is completely natural, and the discontent is the motivation to do something, to change the world, to turn up the air conditioning, whatever it is, open an umbrella, get food. But there's that motivation to do something, to change the world, to make things better again. And when we do that, when we deal with whatever it is, then naturally we should just return to being content again. However, with human beings, we seem to spend most of our time actually in discontent rather than contentment. If you look at your dog or your cat or whatever else pets you have, your horse, most of the time animals are content. They're living in that state of contentment. It's us human beings who you think, being the smart, intelligent, clever, able to do anything we want in the world, solve any problem with all this creativity and innovation, we should be the ones who should actually have solved everything and be more content than your average dog. But we're not. What happens with human beings is, when there is something that needs attention, several things happen. I say we step out of that state of natural mind into, it's really a problem-solving mind. There's something that needs taken care of. We bring our innovative capacities in, and we start thinking about the situation. And if you look at a lot of your thoughts, they're either, particularly just your idle thoughts, or when you're meditating or driving or things, when you're not really working on a real problem, you're assessing what's going on, deciding what you might do, what you might not do, planning how things could be. A lot of them, as I said, maybe we're just in imaginary worlds, imagining what might happen, what might not happen. A lot of problems that actually never actually appear. I think it was Mark Twain who said, "My life has been full of disasters, most of which never happened." So because we've got this incredible power of imagination, we get lost in it. When there's actually no problems to be solved, we get lost in it. And it takes us out of the present moment. We start moving into the past, the future. We move into a sort of, I call it a secondary reality. We lose contact with this primary reality of here, now. And we move into this other reality of what might happen, how do I deal with this, whatever. And we get lost in this secondary reality, which is full of maybe a sense of something missing, something we need to avoid. It's all got this sense of discontent about it. Trying to return to a state of contentment. I sometimes think the sad joke about human beings is, deep down, we all want to be at peace or return to being at peace. And we're so worried, anxious, thinking, concerned about how can we be at peace in the future, we don't actually give ourselves the chance to be in the present. And this is the sad thing that happens, we are creating discontent. And so veiling that natural sense of contentment that is always available, and also veiling that sense of just that I of the pure experiencer, because when we move into that other reality of working out what to do, what not to do, solving problems, in that we create a real image of ourselves, usually based on the body, which is to do with how am I going to survive? Ultimately, it's survival programming. What do I need? What don't I need? And so we have this image of ourselves as a character in the story that needs to be taken care of, needs to do things, that gets excited, whatever. And that's all just part of the story. And there's the I still there, aware of the story, aware of all that. All of this is happening in awareness. But we totally miss that because we are so caught up in all this thinking, which seems so important at the time. And I think one of the reasons we get caught up in it is we are so good at changing the world. You know, we can make almost anything we like. And so we've fallen into the belief that if there's something, if we're not happy, if we're not at peace, then we need to do something about it. And it's a belief that's almost hypnotized into us from birth, that we need to do something, we need to change the world in order to be happy. And that keeps us, I think one of the main things, it just keeps us locked into this mode of consciousness. And the waking up is really waking out of that mode of consciousness. And it is a sort of dreamlike mode, this secondary reality. It's a bit like a dream. I mean, dreams are something that get created. A nightly dream is created in our awareness out of bits of memory, past experience, maybe little things filtering in from the outside world. But it's a created, imagined reality. And in the same way, we get caught in this imagined daytime reality. And so when teachers talk about waking up from the dream, that life is a dream, I think one thing they're pointing to is that we actually spend a lot of our lives living in this dream reality, trying to take care of this individual, derived, constructed sense of self. And the awakening, the real awakening, is the waking up from this half-awake state to the full awareness of being here ourselves in this moment. And one question I use for myself, which I find a really useful way of just coming back to the moment, is just a very simple question: am I not the one that is aware of this? When I'm caught up in some story, some worry, something's going around my mind again and again, whatever it is just to pause and say, am I not the one that is aware of this? And it just allows me just to stop, step back, and say, ah, yes, of course. You just reconnect with that sense of beingness. It isn't about, waking up isn't about going somewhere amazing. It's really just about coming back to ourselves in the present moment. It's as simple as that. As I used to think, it was, you know, an amazing, flashy experience, something like that. But just realizing, in the words of an old Buddhist saying, there is actually nowhere to go. There is nothing to do, and there is no one to be. But it's actually our wanting to get somewhere else, thinking we have to do something to get there and be someone, that actually overshadows and obscures what I call just the natural mind, which is really what we want to return to. But we're looking to return to the natural mind by getting the world right, instead of realizing it's the fact we think the world is wrong that is standing in the way, that's veiling this natural state. And this is why I'm so excited about these times, this period we are passing through. Because I think for the first time in the history of humanity, we are collectively beginning to understand what awakening is, what it means, and why it is so important. Because I think so many of our problems, our challenges, what's going wrong in the world, come back to the fact in one way or another that we're only half awake to ourselves. We've woken up, but only half awake. We've sort of woken up to the dream, but not fully awake to ourselves. And it really, I think it started back in the 60s, this spiritual renaissance, global spiritual renaissance that's happening. One of the things I'm interested in is the creative process in general. And in very simple terms, you can divide the creative process up in different ways, but there's usually there's problems you want to solve. This is the creative process in problem solving. There's problems you want to solve. There's things you've tried. There's frustrations. Things aren't right. You don't know what to do. And then there's that moment, the creative flash, that moment of insight, the aha, aha, this is what I need to do. And then the third phase of the creative process is the actual doing it, carrying it out, turning it into reality. And I think the 60s, particularly the sort of mid-late 60s, 66, 67, 68, were a creative flash for humanity, triggered, as we know, by the sudden arrival in society of psychedelics, which broke open people's view of reality that had been there for centuries, been a slowly evolving view. But there was that frustration, particularly after coming after the Second World War. There was a sense of there must be something else. Where are we going? And suddenly, the psychedelics appeared and open people up to a whole new vision of reality and to the value of spirituality. I mean, it's interesting how many people back then had that opening from the psychedelics, and then as the Beatles and many other, within a year or two, had turned and say, yes, but you know, there's other ways to achieve this besides taking chemicals, and we immediately turned, looked to India, and started going out to India, finding gurus, finding spiritual teachings. We were now into the third part of the creative process. We'd had that flash, probably best summarized as sort of peace and love, man. And it's true, peace and love. What more could we want? What more could we wish for? To be at peace, to experience love, to give love, to feel love. Two absolutely fundamental motivations of consciousness. We may laugh and say, oh, peace and love, yes, you know, it's just very... It isn't. It's absolutely fundamental. People had woken up to that is what it's about. And then we're on this long process of how do we actually do that? How do we actually create a culture where we can be at peace, where we all can actually reconnect with that inner peace? How do we create a culture whereby we can actually be love, feel love, experience love, give love? How do we do that? And that's where the inner work comes in. We've been on this journey now, 60 years of exploration of how to do that. We went through the guru phase. We went through the great big EST workshop phase. Then we started coming back to ourselves, and it was the therapy phase. All of these, I'm not saying any of these aren't valuable, but we've been going through phases. And I think, the cutting edge of spirituality for the last 5 years, 10 years has been the non-dual phase of coming back to, it's really Advaita, coming back to the recognition that there is nowhere to go. It's about letting go of all the obstructions to the realization of who we are. And in that process, two things. One, it is accelerating. It's on its own exponential curve. We're all familiar, I think most of us familiar, with exponential curves in technology and science, Moore's Law in computing. Many of you probably read Kurzweil's books on the singularity that's coming when computers maybe become as smart as human beings and what happens then. These are all accelerating curves of development produced by positive feedback in the system. Each development makes it easier or faster for the next development. And so evolution accelerates. It naturally accelerates. And we could go back looking from the beginning of life and the beginning of the universe, how it took, you know, billions of years for this to happen, millions of years for this to happen, thousands of years, you know, since the agricultural revolution, the industrial revolution 200 years ago. You know, now we have a new operating system every year, a new edition of Firefox every 3 months. It's all accelerating because each stage makes it easier for the next stage. And it's exactly the same or exactly parallel phenomena with our spiritual awakening. Because when I go back to when I first got interested in this stuff, back in the late 60s, I would go into my local bookstore in Cambridge, in England, which was the second largest bookstore in England. And if you look for alternative non-Christian spirituality, there was a shelf up in the religious section in the corner that long. And that was it. You know, the books by Christopher Isherwood and odd translations of the Upanishads, I think. That was it. And I probably read a third of them at that time. That was it. You know, now any modest town or village has its own alternative bookstore. Thousands and thousands and thousands of books and videos and tapes, and you can go on the internet and access far, far more. And all of that has come from individuals on their own journey, making their own discoveries, integrating what other people have said, sharing that, which becomes part of the fodder material for other people to read and digest and share. And so we are collectively waking each other up. We are in this process, really, of stripping away all the clothing, the paraphernalia, the dressing that's been put on that core spiritual teaching. I believe the core spiritual teaching is the same in every tradition. It appears so different because of culture and time, how things have been translated. But underneath, my belief is they're all pointing to exactly the same thing, but have been dressed up in very different ways. And we are gradually taking away all those different cultural trappings and getting down to what is that core spiritual message, understanding, realization. And because we are all learning from each other, it is happening faster and faster and faster and faster. And so, I mean, most people say that, you know, they've become far more awake in the last few years than the last 5 years or 10 years before that. And today, I think we have this, we have many awakened people popping up in our own culture. We don't need to go to India anymore to find them. Teachers are popping up everywhere who, through their own work over the years, have let go of the dream and come back to their true nature. And as we do that, it just gets simpler and simpler and simpler. I maybe just to finish, just to share with you where I am at with my own process in this. It's all to do with the attention. The attention. And when we attend to something, it's like the attention is like the spotlight of consciousness, the spotlight of awareness. You know, right now my awareness, there's this room, there's also my sensations in my body, there's thoughts going through my mind. You all have a whole range of experience in your awareness, but there's always that spotlight of awareness on something. Sometimes it's very focused, sometimes it's more diffuse, but it's what you are attending to. And the eye is on one end. There's the eye attending to some aspect of the experience. And as I said, we get lost in what we're attending to because it seems so important or entertaining or so frightening or so interesting. We never notice the I-ness that is attending. And when we move out of that natural state of mind where the attention is just relaxed, when we move into that concerned, worried, problem-solving mode, the ego mode, the attention actually gets focused. There's a slight tension that creeps in. And some of you, if you meditate, or maybe not meditate, you may notice this, how it's almost like you can feel your consciousness becoming slightly contracted, slightly constricted. It's like the feeling of complete ease has gone, and there's a slight tension in the mind. And this is really the hallmark of the ego mind, the hallmark of the individual self when it's operating, is there's a slight sense of tension. Sometimes a big sense of tension, but there's always some sense of tension, maybe very faint. I say the best way I can verbalize it for myself is there's a constriction in consciousness. And if we can recognize that, whatever you're thinking about, whatever you're doing, if you can notice that slight sense of tension, that slight sense of constriction, and let your awareness be with that, with how, no way to put it, with how your attention is feeling, then you can, when you do that, you often find it just begins to dissolve and you can drop back into that natural state of beingness. And as I talk about it, just, you know, wherever your attention is at the moment, whether it's listening to me, whether it's off daydreaming, whether it's working out something you've got to do at home or whatever, wherever your attention is, notice if you're focusing on something, how that slight sense of constriction can come in. And just by noticing that, we can let the attention itself soften and relax. And when we let the attention soften and relax, we drop back into our own sense of self, into our own beingness. And this to me is such a simple practice and something we can do at any moment of the day, wherever we are, to continually notice that sense of tightness, constriction in the mind, and by letting it relax, just drop back into our own sense of presence. We'll be off again in 2 seconds, 30 seconds, it doesn't matter. The practice is not about how do we stay present. The practice is about how do we return to being present. That's the practice. If you try to stay there, you'll just create more tension and things. It's about how do we let the attention soften and relax. And so we just drop back into our own beingness as we do that. So I think I'll pause there. We've got a few minutes, 10 minutes, I think, for questions, comments, whatever. I always think the talk is just setting a playing field. and then we can play in the playing field of where we go. Yes, yes, back here first of all. Yep. Yes, yeah. I mean, okay, what I should make clear, I didn't say at all, is there's times when we do need to be focused, there's times when we need to be problem-solving, which is naturally helping us move forward. And there's times when we don't need to be, but we got into the habit of, I say, solving problems which don't even exist a lot of the time. Because we're so good at problem-solving, we're doing it when we don't need to be doing it. So yes, it's a very valuable human asset. It's made us what we are. But we get seduced by it and start doing it. We fall into that mode when we don't need to be doing it. And so we fall into all that sort of thinking that's unnecessary. And that's why I think so many traditions focus in one way or another on how do we step back from that unnecessary thinking. But there's certainly times when it's very necessary, very useful, and is helping us move forward, yes. It's about having a balance between action, focused, life, and stepping back. So it's about coming back more towards dog consciousness. Yes, okay. Yes, Willow.
I don't know if this is just a semantic difficulty, but when you began, you'd made a distinction between natural consciousness and problem-solving consciousness. And after listening to Barbara, what I wondered is natural consciousness itself actually attempting to evolve through us? In other words, do we not, are we going to move from sort of the Advaita tradition to a kind of co-creative spirituality which would feel different from some of the ways you've been describing, but I think you actually subscribe to that.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, as I said, I see us all, we're all evolving together, we're co-evolving, and that's what makes this exciting and is accelerating it. And I don't know what's next in some ways, because all I know is in the past, whenever I made predictions about the long-term future, they turned out to be wrong. Because I think sometimes we cannot see what's going to happen with innovation, we can only think in terms of the present, our present context. And I see, and I know as Barbara does, there's some collective awakening is possible, is maybe imminent. I hesitate to even begin to describe what that might look like. It's the old thing of a caterpillar describing what it's like to fly as a butterfly. All it can do is think about wiggling all its little legs. Mm-hmm. You know, we're caught in how we see things.
Is that?
Yeah. Yeah, it's difficult to form this question, but it has to do with the sense that when you reach your true point of consciousness, the I, the real I, it's not really an individual awareness.
Right.
It's a group, mass consciousness awareness. Could you speak to that?
Yes. I mean, the way I see it, it's not so much reaching something as recognizing something that's already there. So it's not something we attain, but it's already present. We just don't recognize it because our attention is elsewhere. And I think when we do recognize it, as I was saying, we recognize it, it is a universal quality that we all share. So yeah. It's not we're attaining something else that's different, but we're just recognizing that universal sense of beingness that wants to be at peace, that we are all we all want the same thing, which is to be loved, to be respected. And that's what holds us all together ultimately.
And the sense of love is recognizing our connection to someone else or some other group or some other thing.
Yes, and I would say recognizing the connection that you and I ultimately want the same. But what can so easily happen in any interaction is, you know, you say something to me, and for something that's in the back of my mind, some past experience, I slightly misinterpret you. You meant it completely kindly with a full open heart, and something in me misperceives it, takes it as a slight affront, I get slightly hurt, and then, if I'm not fully awake, because I'm feeling a little peeved, I come back to you with just maybe a little edge to my response or something. Now you're feeling attacked yourself because I was attacking you, and you come back to me, and this is what happens in relationship. We get two people both wanting to be loved, and they're playing this game of like, I'm going to just, you know, nudge the knife a little bit, tweak you a little bit, because then you'll realize the error of your ways and love me back.
Kind of like being married.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. This is what happens. I mean, it's funny, but it's very sad that two people looking for love are trying to get love by annoying the other person. And it doesn't work. However, and this is where knowing that we both want the same thing, if you come from that perspective, and that so in any interaction, this is really the golden rule of all spiritual traditions, in any interaction, let me give you what I would want. So it means in any interaction, how can I speak, act, so that you don't feel hurt, so that my intention is that you feel loved, respected, rather than attacked or criticized. And when two people start doing that, they have the agreement that in any interaction, we want the other person to feel loved. I mean, one of the Buddha's definitions of right speech is, if you can't say anything in a way that the other person feels good upon hearing it, it's better to retain noble silence until you've worked out how to say it. But when you start doing that in a relationship, love really begins to enter into it in a whole new way.
You just saved my marriage. I'm kidding. Thank you very much.
Okay. Time is up.